Hello and welcome to the Anonymous Anthropologist Podcast with your host, the Anonymous Anthropologist. That's me. I am a community college professor of anthropology with more than 10 years of teaching in the classroom and a master's degree from Columbia University. I'd happily tell you more about me if only I could be sure that it wouldn't get me fired. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. I am the Anonymous Anthropologist here with you today to talk a little bit about culture. That's probably something I should have talked about a while ago, as it is a podcast about anthropology, and culture is central to that. I mentioned in the last podcast that I wanted to spend this one responding to some listener questions, and that is what I'm going to do, although it turns out that I'll really only be working on one question at a time. I went back and looked at all the wonderful questions and responses I received from listeners, and I realized that many of them demand podcasts of their own. So I am going to begin doing that intermittently between covering topics of my own choosing. So I'd like to thank you, those of you who sent me questions or podcast suggestions, and I do intend to get around to them. I know that I had a really great response to the podcast I did on guns from Gavin. So thank you, Gavin. I'm certain that I will be devoting a future podcast in its entirety to that subject and to the points that you raised. Thanks again very much for that. Had a great letter from Bree in Illinois. Thanks, Bree. Be getting around to your comments and questions pretty soon. Mary Claire in Ireland, thank you so much for writing and for your list of wonderful show suggestions, some of which I will certainly be taking on in the future. But today I'm going to address a question posed to me by loyal listener Frank in New Mexico. And those of you who listen to the podcast have heard me mention Frank a couple of times. He has been an excellent correspondent. I'm not certain that Frank and I are of exactly the same political persuasion, but we do have a lot in common, and we certainly do have a spirited dialogue. So thanks again, Frank. So this podcast on culture was actually inspired by a question of yours, which was, why aren't all cultures the same? And I looked at that and I thought, wow, you know, that really is actually a good question. Because as you pointed out in your letter, you say, aren't all bee cultures and antelope cultures the same? And I thought, yeah, but we're not bees or antelopes. We're human beings. And then I thought, well, what does that mean? And I realized that we anthropologists really only like to use that word culture for human beings. And so the first response that I sent to Frank pointed that out and said, well, you know, anthropologists and zoologists are fairly well concerned to restrict the use of the word cultures to the human animal as a way of setting us apart. When we talk about non-human animal interaction, then we can use the word society. I think that's probably the word zoologists use. Feel free to correct me if there are any zoologists out there. But culture is usually restricted by anthropologists and zoologists to the human species. And because its use is restricted, we really have to be able to define it. So Frank and I went on to have a bit more of a conversation about, well, the whole idea that only human beings can have culture. And we agreed that there's probably some ego in that, the idea that the human species has always felt a need to separate ourselves from the rest of the animal kingdom, perhaps in order to make it easier to accept the fact that we raise members of the animal kingdom for slaughter and consumption. We don't think of ourselves as animals. We think of ourselves as somehow above the animals. I once had a disagreement with a six-year-old when I said that we were animals. She vehemently disagreed. No, I'm not an animal. And I said, well, you're not a vegetable or a mineral, and those are the only other categories, so you must be an animal. Later on, she came to see the logic of that, but I suppose to a six-year-old, it's hard to fathom. So yes, there is definitely a need in the human species to separate ourselves. It's in the book of Genesis, I believe, the idea that the animals were created by God and placed there for us to use and exploit. The earth is our domain. We are in charge of it. We are masters of it, and second in command only to God and later on to Christ, if you're a Christian, of course. But that is central to the Abrahamic theologies. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, the idea that the earth was created for human beings to use and enjoy and exploit. And indeed, in the United States, there are some fundamentalist Christians who believe that global warming could never happen because God won't allow it to happen, and we can do whatever we want to the planet, and it's okay with the Almighty. So if the question is, why aren't all cultures the same? Why do cultures differ? The first thing we have to do is to define exactly what culture is. And I tell my students on the first day of the cultural anthropology class that that's really not an easy thing to do. I think that every anthropologist has their own definition for exactly what culture is, and some of them are rather long-winded. They go on quite a ways. One of the more famous definitions of culture, and also one of the more extensive ones, comes from the early anthropologist E.B. Tyler, who wrote in 1871. He said that culture is, and I'm quoting here, that complex whole which includes knowledge, belief, art, morals, law, custom, and any other capabilities and habits acquired by man as a member of society. That's the way Tyler defined culture in 1871. And he uses the word man in the definition. So if we use culture to define man, then we cannot use man to define culture, which makes that not a really great definition. Although it does encompass quite a lot. Knowledge, belief, art, morals, law, custom. It's a pretty broad definition, and it includes a lot of things, and we can look at them individually and say, well, do animals have these things? Do non-human animals have these things? And while non-human animals have knowledge, we can't be so certain that they have belief or art or morals or law or custom. Those are tougher things to see in non-human animals. Later on in the 1970s, anthropologist Clifford Geertz gave us a more modern definition, which says that culture is a historically transmitted pattern of meanings embodied in symbols, a system of inherited conceptions expressed in symbolic forms by means of which men communicate, perpetuate, and develop their knowledge about and attitudes toward life. So once again, the word men is actually in the definition. So it's sticky. It's troubling. How can we define culture in a way that does not include the use of the term human, which I think we need to do if we're going to use the word culture to define humanity? The simplest way to conceptualize what culture is to say that it is shared, learned behavior. Shared, learned behavior. Shared meaning that culture is not something that you can say one animal or one human has. It's shared by a group. Learned meaning that the knowledge of it is acquired during the individual's lifetime. It's not something they're born knowing. It's something that they are either taught or intuit from the world around them. And behavior, because anthropologists can never really be certain what people are thinking, but only what they're doing. And behavior is the thing which really communicates what culture is. How do people behave? Well, that's part of their culture. That's a very big, broad, expansive, all-inclusive definition, shared learned behavior. And probably the most important component is the fact that culture is learned. Culture is acquired during life. So what exactly does the human animal learn during its lifetime? Well, pretty much everything. Whatever is not driven by biology is driven by culture. Biology makes us hungry, but culture teaches us what to eat, how to obtain it, and how to consume it. One culture may teach you that the only appropriate things to eat are vegetables, and you will learn to grow them or collect them and prepare them, while another culture will teach you that the only thing available to eat is milk from the cattle that you raise, and that is what you will grow up on. Our culture teaches you that it is appropriate to eat things like McDonald's and Burger King, which I have to say have nothing to do with real food. So everything, down to what you eat, where you get it, how you process it, how you consume it, that comes from your culture. Biology makes you sleepy, but culture will provide you with the bed or the hammock or the pile of straw upon which you sleep. So the material items of your everyday life are also part of culture, whether you use forks and knives or chopsticks, or just your fingers. That's culture. Culture determines that, not biology. I don't know of any animals that use anything other than their mouths and perhaps their hands to eat. I don't see any animals using cutlery. So I know that sounds kind of funny, but that's a very uniquely human behavior, to construct a tool for the sole purpose of eating. It's unusual. We see stuff like that among primates. There are always going to be examples of apes or monkeys practicing behaviors that are similar to our own, and the simple reason for that is because we are just a more highly evolved form of primate. We are primates. Just like the apes and the monkeys, we are primates. There are a whole host of characteristics that we share with them, and perhaps I'll do a podcast on that at some time. But for now, suffice it to say that we are extraordinarily closely related to the primates, the non-human primates, chimpanzees, for example. And so some of what we think is uniquely human, we will see in animals like chimpanzees. But you're not going to see it in dogs or horses or cows or lizards or snakes or fish. In other words, it's exclusive to primates. Even among mammals, these behaviors are exclusive to primates. So I want to be clear here and say that some of the things that we think of as being exclusively human, we share with the non-human primates because we are indeed primates ourselves. So anthropologists are actually divided over whether or not to call these apparently cultural behaviors in non-human primates, whether or not to even call them culture. And it's probably about a 50-50 split between those who say, yes, those are cultural traits, and that's why human beings have culture, because we inherited it from our primate ancestors. And others will say, no, culture is what defines the human being, so we can't allow apes to have it. I am definitely a member of the first camp. I believe that our cultural traits evolved from traits present in previous species all the way back to ancestral primates. As a matter of fact, when we study primatology and physical anthropology, one of our concerns is to separate, once again, human beings from apes, because how can we discuss ourselves as a separate category if we can't distinguish ourselves? So we run through a whole list of qualities which are supposed to be possessed only by human beings, only to discover that apes practice them as well. Probably the first scientific debate was over the use of language, whether or not apes had language. And we discovered that, yes, you can teach a chimpanzee sign language, and that once you do that, it will teach sign language to its offspring. And, well, that sounds like culture to me. And so we had to say, okay, maybe it's not language that separates us from the primates. Now, don't get me wrong. Language does separate us from other animals, from other mammals, from non-primate animals. It certainly does. But it is an ability that we probably inherited from our primate ancestors. So once it became clear that human beings could not claim language for their own, we moved on to the idea of sex. And we thought, well, only human beings reproduce face-to-face in a loving embrace in what is commonly referred to as the missionary position. And we were pretty comfortable with that, thinking ourselves fairly superior in the idea of lovemaking as opposed to sex. Whether that's true or not for you personally, I don't know, but that was the scientific premise until research brought us to the bonobos, who are very, very closely related to chimpanzees. Some say bonobo, some say bonobo. Bonobos are referred to incorrectly as sexy monkeys, and what's incorrect about that is that they're apes, not monkeys, but they are indeed sexy. They are the only primates, aside from ourselves, who engage in sex on a regular basis whenever they feel like it. All the other primates, just like all the other, well, almost all of the other mammals, have an estrus cycle, which means that females become receptive to sexual activity only at certain times of the year. And that is the only time that the males will be able to get super friendly with them. Bonobos, like humans, do not have an estrus cycle, and so they are sexually active throughout the year, throughout the day, throughout the month. So there went the specialness of human sexuality. One of the earlier arguments was about tool making. We used to think that only human beings made tools. And when you look at beavers building a dam, you can see that they use their teeth and their tails and whatnot, but they don't use hammers and nails. So making tools seemed to be uniquely human. That is, until we observed chimpanzees breaking off twigs and stripping them down, making little sharp pointy ends, and poking them into termite mounds to pull out a nice little skewer full of termites for them to eat. And then we saw them crumbling up large leaves, chewing them up in their mouths, making them a little mushy, and then using those mushy leaves as water sponges to sop up water that was collected, say, in the hollow of a tree, and then wring the water out into their open mouths. It's pretty amazing. So we do see chimpanzees making and using tools. We've even seen female chimpanzees use sharpened sticks to kill smaller primates for food. So the tool use is not uniquely human. And then we got all negative. It wasn't tools, it wasn't sex, it wasn't language. Maybe it's war. Maybe human beings are the only ones who intentionally kill members of their own species, because we hadn't really ever seen that before until we saw the chimpanzees tearing each other limb from limb. They apparently do that too. Chimpanzees live in very closely knit groups. Sometimes for one reason or another, a male chimpanzee may leave the group, and if he is foolish enough to try to take some females with him, the other males have been known to hunt him down and kill him. So there is something akin to warfare, or at least the killing of members of one's own species, seen among the primates. So to return to the question of culture, we have to say that there are precursors for human culture seen in non-human primates, but that it's difficult to extend or extrapolate any of that out to other animals, other non-primate mammals or reptiles or fish or birds or anything like that. So human culture is composed of everything that you learn. It's your language, it's your faith, it's your identity, it's your opinions, it's your politics. It's also composed of everything you expect, such as that there be a bed in your bedroom or a refrigerator in your kitchen. If you lived in a tent, you wouldn't expect those things. It is the plans that you make for your future. It is the experiences of your past. It is your entire construction of self. It's everything that isn't biological. That's culture. It is a huge thing. So when you take this broad view and you see all that culture encompasses, you realize that even if you want to attribute culture to non-human animals, they certainly do not possess the complexity or this whole host of characteristics that the human culture has. I can isolate for you a couple of things that are definitely unique to human culture, things where there is really no animal analogy. The first one is language. Language is tough to talk about because we do know that other animals communicate. Some communicate through body language, some communicate through scent. If communication is happening between two members of the same species, then can you call that language? Well, not necessarily. Because the definition of language is based on the fact that it is symbolic. And what that means is that there's no connection between the symbol, in other words, the word, and the concept, the thing it represents. Human language is purely symbolic. There is no relationship between the word cat, C-A-T, and the animal that it represents. No real physical relationship at all. We just all agree that when I say that word cat, that I mean that four-legged furry creature that runs around the room at 3 a.m. in the morning. As a matter of fact, if I went to France and I talked about a cat, they would not know what I was talking about. I would have to add an H and say chat, and then perhaps they might recognize that I'm talking about that same feline. If I were to go to Spain and try that, they would once again not understand me. I would have to change the word significantly into gato. And so you can see that those words are purely symbolic. When the meaning of something changes because you change its context, you know that it is symbolic. Language is purely symbolic. It bears no connection to the thing it represents. And it's hard to see, again, an analog for that in non-human animals. Human language is also characterized by two very specific qualities. They're referred to as displacement and productivity. By displacement, we mean that human beings have an ability to discuss anything that is anywhere at any time. We can displace an event in time and in space. So we can talk about things that happened yesterday or last year or a million years ago or things that will happen tomorrow or 10 days from now or 1,000 years from now, and that is displacement in time. And we can talk about things that happened in France or in Ireland or in New Mexico or on the moon, and that is displacement in space. And while we do know that animals can communicate, it's hard to call animal communication language because we're fairly certain that their communication is limited to the moment. Chimpanzees will communicate to each other, hey, look out, there's a predator in the sky, and they will all crawl into the bushes for camouflage. But they will not sit around later on talking about it. Hey, remember when that predator came by and we all went to hide? We're pretty sure that doesn't happen, that displacement in time. We're also pretty sure that they don't get together to talk about that great hunting ground over there that far away. No, they probably just get up and go there without very much communication at all. So that quality for displacement in time and space is, we believe, unique to human communication. The other quality we think is unique is infinite productivity. We are always making up new words and new concepts. We're always formulating unique sentences, saying things that have never been said before. And while, again, chimpanzees do seem to have a repertoire of calls or sounds that they make, which each have a very specific meaning in their troop, in their specific group, they don't seem to invent new calls. They don't seem to combine them to create new meanings. They don't seem to have that creativity of language that human beings possess. So language is crucial to the definition of human culture. Without this kind of sophisticated, symbolic, linguistic capacity, we would never manage to build a house or a road or a railroad or really much of anything. So language is going to be critical to any definition of human culture. There is, for me, another favorite topic, another characteristic of culture that I like to talk about, and that is cooking. Food in general is a great thing to talk about when you want to discuss how unique human beings are. I have mentioned in many other podcasts the idea of binary oppositions. We've talked a lot about those. And I think once upon a time I may have given credit to the great scholar Claude Lévi-Strauss for really bringing that approach to our attention. He is the father of the school of thought in anthropology that's known as structuralism, which points out that human beings tend to view things in opposite extremes, binary opposites, black and white, good and bad. And in one of Lévi-Strauss's books, The Raw and the Cooked is a very classic opposition. So it does appear that human beings are the only animal that cooks its food. That's worth considering, isn't it? Why on earth do we cook our food? No other animal has to do it, and the food doesn't kill them. They manage to eat raw things and survive. And human beings, however, we cook our food, particularly our meat. Now, I know there are you raw foodies out there, people who don't believe in cooking, and I just want to tell you, for your information, that human beings didn't even invent cooking, just so you know, okay? Cooking is something that was inherited by the human species. Yeah, you see, because we can date cooking and the use of fire for cooking back over 1.5 million years. Yeah, that's before we even showed up on the planet. That was Homo erectus. There's lots of evidence for Homo erectus cooking food over 1 million years ago, maybe 1.5 million years ago. And we inherited that ability, that knowledge, and that preference from that previous species. So the human species as we know it today, Homo sapiens sapiens, if you want to be really specific, we never didn't cook. Okay, my raw foodie friends, just a little point of information for you. So it's fascinating to ask, why did we begin cooking? Oh, it is such a lot of work, isn't it? Well, cooking and food is such a tremendous part of culture. If you think about it, it's the best way to make a friend is to sit down to a meal, to go out to dinner, to invite them to dinner. Breaking bread together is such a huge cultural practice in every culture. When you are an anthropologist and you travel or you do research, it is so important to dine with people. It is the central highlight of human activity. There are cultures where the whole focus of the culture is just to obtain enough food to cook dinner. And so you spend most of the time looking for food and a lot of time preparing food and a fair amount of time consuming it. We wonder how human beings began cooking, and I always have this image in my mind of there being some kind of a lightning strike, maybe a dry spell, maybe a forest fire that just scares everybody and everybody flees. And then when they come back, they're walking through the charred remains of the forest, and all of a sudden it's, what is that? Ooh, that smells good, you know, and they find these dead animals and, well, charred dead animals, what could be bad? And so I think, you know, that's possible, that that's how cooking was discovered. It's just an idea, no way to really prove it. There's another thing that's very unique about this cooking, and that's that human beings will share food with almost any other human being. And that's a pretty unique behavior, because even chimpanzees are reluctant to share food within their own group. There's this famous zoo experiment, and granted, you don't get realistic results in a zoo environment, but you get zoo results. But there is this famous experiment in a zoo, I think it was a Scandinavian zoo, where they hung a banana just out of reach of this one chimpanzee named Dandy. And he had the things there in his enclosure that he could figure out how to get to the banana, and that's exactly what he did. He stacked up some boxes, he made himself a structure, he climbed up, and he reached and he got the banana. In the next phase of the experiment, the experimenters, they dismantled Dandy's construction, and they let out the chimpanzees from his exhibit. They let the other chimpanzees join him, and they hung another banana. And these other chimpanzees were trying to figure out how to get the banana. Do you think that Dandy helped them? No, he did not. He sat in a corner and quietly ate his own banana while they struggled to figure it out. So I think human beings would probably help. At least I'd like to think human beings would help and say, hey, you know, if you stack those boxes, you might get that banana. It's very unique human behavior. We will eat with anyone. We will feed anyone. And you really don't see that in the animal kingdom. There's something about the smell of food cooking that draws animals. It draws animals, draws my dog. It sure does. I bet it draws your dog. And it draws human beings, too. It creates a social activity. And then if you look at the history of cooking and cuisine, there's a whole culture that rises up around special cooking done for elites, which takes all day and skilled teams of practitioners. There's cooking that only men do and cooking that only women do. It's incredible. It's such a tremendous part of human existence, and it really, really sets us apart from the other animals. Cooking and sharing food. There are lots of other things that we could talk about that separate us from the non-human animals in terms of culture. There are things like construction and tool use. It's true that chimpanzees will use tools, but it's also true that only a human being will use one tool to make another tool and then use that tool to make a thing. That's a level of complexity that you do not see in non-human animals. So what I've tried to do here is to explain to you exactly what human culture is and why we like to restrict the use of the word to just human beings. And that's really the first step in answering Frank's original question, which once again was, why aren't all cultures the same? And since I've spent most of this podcast addressing that sort of pre-question, I've got to give you a bit of a short answer on the original question. And that's, I think, maybe intuitive by now. Because different cultures are placed in different locations at different times with different resources. Because culture is learned, the location and the resources have tremendous impact on that culture. It's really that simple. If culture were biological, if it were inherited, like it may be among bees and antelopes, then it would all be the same. There wouldn't be any different cultures. There would just be one human culture. But it's not inherited. It's learned. And the circumstances of your learning differ greatly from place to place and group to group and time to time. So it makes sense that we're going to have a great diversity of human cultures. There's also an evolutionary argument to make about this. If all human cultures were precisely the same, then we would all be vulnerable to the same problems, to the same hazards. It's the way we look at things when we talk about biology and evolution. If we were all the same biologically or genetically, then we would all be taken out by the first disease, and so that's not a very good adaptive strategy for the human species from a biological point of view. Well, you could try applying that point of view to cultural anthropology and say that if we all had exactly the same culture and one collapsed, then everyone else would too. So from an evolutionary point of view, which generally I don't like to apply to culture, it is really a biological concept, but if you want to reason by analogy, just for a little moment here, you could say that having a diversity of cultures would act to preserve the species in much the same way as having a diversity of genetic types. It just makes it that much more likely that we will, as a species, go on to survive. I have a little programming note here. I think it took me a little longer than usual to get out this most recent podcast, and I do apologize for that. I want to let you know that I'm going to be changing the schedule a little bit. I was shooting for a release every 10 to 12 days, but that has become a little less manageable for me right now. I've got some other projects that I'm involved in. So I think that I'm just going to shoot for 2 podcasts a month, twice per month for now. So please forgive this most recent delay, and you can expect another podcast sometime before the end of the month. I want to thank all my listeners all over the world. Thank you very much for listening, for calling in, for participating, for writing in. I will spend later shows addressing your questions and concerns. Very, very grateful for all of the correspondence. I invite you to call me at the phone line. It's 206-312-3526. That's 206-312-3526. Or you can write to me at theanonymousanthropologist@gmail.com. That's theanonymousanthropologist@gmail.com. Like me on the Facebook page. I will keep an eye on that. You can send me comments there as well. I look forward to speaking with you again in a couple of weeks. Thanks, as always, for listening and for participating. Until next time, take care.
Am I recording?